Hello, friends, and welcome back to What Page Are You On? I'm Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my co-host,
Alice Slater.
This is a new kind of episode for us. We're trying something new. This is the What Page Are You On book club, and I'm going to hand over to my buddy Alice, who's going to explain how it will work.
So, for our book club, I know it's, I feel like we announced this so long ago, but there was a lot of shit to work out.
Yeah.
So, for the first Monday of each month is going to be our book club episode drop, where Bethany and I are going to do an episode of the podcast, and we're going to discuss our chosen book in great detail, full of spoilers, no holds barred, no editing out of, can we say that, is that going to be okay? The following Tuesday in the evening, we're going to have a Twitter chat about the book, so you guys can join in and tell us what you think and tell us what you agree with and disagree with. And that's going to be under a hashtag, which each month will change, so you can mute the relevant hashtag so you don't have the book spoiled for you. And that hashtag will be hashtag WPAYO and then the book title.
So this month there will be hashtag WPAYO lullaby. Cool. I think that's all we've covered. We've covered everything we wanted to tell you about this new little thing we're trying. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. I feel, like I said, that we had this idea before Christmas.
Yeah, we had this idea on the last time it snowed, and we talked about it in Wetherspoons.
Oh my god, yeah. We did, and now it snowed again, and we're here.
Exactly. Cool. Okay, hit me. Oh, also, the things that we talk about on this episode will be the same questions in general that we put in the chat. So if ever you're listening to this episode and you're like, oh, I want to reply to that, you will get your chance.
Yeah,
like, you will get your chance to chip in. And, like, I think another nice thing about the chat, which will happen the day after the episode comes out, is that you can, like, find other people that listen to the podcast through the hashtag, and you can bond because you'll probably like all the same books, just like you like all the same books that we do.
That's so true.
That is so true. Bringing people together. Okay, cool. So, shall we summarize Lullaby?
Yeah, I'll let you summarize Lullaby.
Okay, so Lullaby is a book by Leila Slimani, and it is about a couple who employ a nanny to look after their two small children. They are, like, you know, fairly well-off Parisian couple who live in an apartment, and the first line of the novel is that the nanny kills the children. And the novel is kind of about how it got to that point and the lives of the family, the life of the nanny, different people semi-related to the story. Just about her working there and also, like, things around her life. And, yeah, that's the book, right?
Yeah, and I think... So one thing I want to point out straight away is that actually in the only chapter it doesn't specify...
That the nanny killed them. Oh, interesting.
Because I reread the first sort of third in bed this morning. And because I know that a few people were disappointed by the ending.
Yeah.
Because the ending is just essentially the opening.
Yeah.
Like, loops around, right? And so rereading the beginning, I wondered if it was because it's marketed as a thriller, I wondered if people were expecting a more kind of
explosive
neat,
or...
Either, like, a kind of neater ending or a twist.
Interesting.
But there is no twist. And we both read it as... From the beginning, from the get-go, we kind of assumed it was Louise that commits the murders.
Yeah.
But actually, the opening line is...
The baby is dead. It only took a few seconds.
Which, honestly, that's up there with Camus for me in terms of opening lines.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, actually, in the kind of the little prologue, it's like 2-3 pages. You know that it's the only mention of the other person in the situation... is they had to save the other one too, of course, with the same level of professionalism, without emotion. She didn't know how to die, she only knew how to give death.
Interesting.
It doesn't say that it's the nanny. So I wonder if some people reading that just like, ah, I bet this is a clue.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know, because yeah. I didn't, but I wonder if that's
no,
me.
No, I totally went into this being like, I know this is theoretically a thriller, but I feel like it's like... a different kind of thriller, where you don't just read it for the plot.
That's actually my second question. My first book club question is just, did you dig it?
Yeah, I dug it.
Yeah, I dug it.
I dug it so hard.
I dug it hard and fast. I had a shovel. I was there digging it 6 feet under.
Yeah. The writing is so good. I just think, whether you think the plot is juicy enough, the writing is so good. I think the plot is juicy too.
Yeah, I was completely riveted. Because it's not a whodunit, it's a whydunit.
Yeah.
And I have time for those. I have loads of examples on my bookshelves of whydunits that are brilliant. The Secret History is a whydunit.
Yeah.
Opens with Bunny's death, which our dear friend Beth...
failed to read the prologue. Missed. Always read the prologue, because you might miss, like, a fundamental part of the plot.
I still would also think that I still class it as a thriller. I think thriller fans have a lot to enjoy.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, things like Patricia Highsmith thrillers aren't like whodunit. I think it falls into a category of like, how did we get there? Like, how did this thing happen? Like, what was the kind of tragic sequence of events that allowed this thing to happen? Like, what were the things that accumulated to make one person feel so backed into a corner, like either psychologically or like in, you know, financially or whatever, that they do something, you know, inhuman. And I think this falls into that category.
Yeah, I agree. And so just before we hit the record button, I asked you if you knew this, but the fact that it's based on a true story.
I did not know that.
So it's based on the 1997 trial of a British nanny.
Oh, is it Louise Woodward? Oh, sorry. When you said, did you know this is based on a true story? And I said, no. I assumed it would be a French thing.
Oh, no.
While I didn't know it was based on that, I do know...
Of that story.
But that's weird because it was very in doubt as to whether she deliberately murdered the child.
The thing, right, is I guess it's slightly misleading to say it's based on a true story because the circumstances were so different.
Yeah.
But what kind of the catalyst for Leila Slimani in writing this book was this quote from the defense lawyer who said to the mother of the child, who was a doctor, that if you wanted your children to be safe, you should have stayed at home.
That's wild.
So it was that idea of like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You let this thing into your house and it's your fault. That's so interesting. That's very, very interesting indeed. when you said that it was based on a true story, I thought it was like a more faithful adaptation of a
like,
thing.
Emma Flynn or Emma
yeah,
Fine,
yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because it's certainly, there's nothing on the cover, it doesn't say, like, based
inspired
on the true
by,
story,
blah, blah, blah.
Inspired by, whatever.
Yeah, and this isn't the story of Louise Woodward at all.
No,
they just have the same name.
But at the same time, like, that's obviously not coincidental, that's a choice. I wonder if the case of Louise Woodward would resonate as much in France or America as it does in the UK.
Yeah.
Like, I was 11, but I remember that whole story.
Whereas I only know about it because I... discovered that Audible make podcasts, and I listened to last week. I listened to the whole series of UK true crime that they've done, which is so interesting. The first episode I listened to was about Louise Woodward,
which is why
I'm very well acquainted with this story, despite not remembering it at all because I'm a baby.
Oh, you are a baby. My next question is about race and class in the book and how those two factors affect the plot.
I feel like the class one is, like, quite obvious.
That is essentially the backbone of the plot, is the class difference between
the employer and the employee. And just, like, her kind of... it feels like she never fully articulates it as a resentment, but just observing the way that she lives in her horrible, depressing flat with, like, the shower that has rotted... and her horrible landlord, and then the life that she kind of slowly, like, weasels her way into in the family's apartment and their holidays and things like that. I think the character of her daughter is, like, a very...
Stephanie.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause she... Louise raises children for a job, and the children that she raises are very well-off middle-class children who she can devote all of her love and attention to. And then there's her daughter, who she just sees as this, like, catastrophic failure, who she has no relationship with, who lives her life in a much more, like, working-class situation. I don't know. There's something there.
Certainly, I think that contrast between Louise's environment and then the environment in which she works is really shocking. Like, there's such a massive difference. And the way that that flat, the way that her living situation drags her mental health down so much to such a degree that she pins all her hopes on Paul and Miriam having another child so they will keep her employed.
So that she'll keep having access to this world.
But of course, it because it's more than just access to the world, because she could just get another job nannying. Yeah. I presume all middle class
French
families
people.
In beautiful Parisian French flats are going to be kind of living similar lifestyles. So there's more than that. What is it? What is it that she feels such a connection with that family?
Yeah, and I wondered that about why she hadn't killed any of her... Why was it this family that she prompted her to, like, murder the children, as opposed to any of the other families she'd ever worked for? And I think... So I only noticed this when I read it for the second time, which I did this week, and at the end of the first chapter, Miriam, who is the woman of the couple, so she's one of the, like... rich French people.
Yeah.
They ring Louise's previous employers to get a reference. And she says, Louise, you're so lucky to have found her. She was like a second mother to my boys. It was heartbreaking. We had to let her go. To be perfectly honest, I even thought of having a third child at the time just so we could keep her. Mm-hmm. And that kind of... Is that foreshadowing? But, like, that plants the idea in the story of... Louise becoming obsessed with the idea of Miriam having another child so that she can be kept on as their nanny. But I don't know, what is that foreshadowing?
When I was reading it, I thought that she was lying. Because I feel like you find so quickly there are so many things about Louise that are odd.
Yeah.
You know, like, she, the fact that she'll hang around outside the flat until the exact moment that it's okay for her to knock on the door. Like, she displays, like, so much kind of strange behaviour. So my first reading, I thought that this woman was just lying to try and make sure that she gets...
Away from...
Yeah. That she finds a new job, that she can, like, she's no longer the first point of contact. That's how I kind of read it. And then rereading it, I'm like, well, obviously not. Of course that's not what it was. Like, it was genuine.
Yeah.
She's genuinely really good with children. She's just not very good with adults.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But yeah, that was, you know, as something that is not important really in the story until near the very end is this idea of, like, I think it is that sets Louise off onto this path of, like, complete destruction, is knowing that at some point they won't need her anymore. So she becomes fixated on this idea of Miriam having another child, and she does everything she can to, like, facilitate that.
Like that weird, where she takes the children out for the night.
Yes.
That really depressing restaurant, and she has no money to do anything with them but...
Yeah, walk around and... Yeah.
Oh, God, that scene is so hard to read, because the kids are just so distressed.
And this, she does this all so that the parents can have time alone together, in which she is just so convinced that they will have sex and it will end up in Miriam getting pregnant. Like, that is... It is so obvious to her that that is what will happen. She is so fixated on it that it's like there is no other option as to the path that her life will take. And then when it doesn't, and Miriam says, like, I'd rather die than have another, you know, than go through all that again. She kind of has to come to terms with the fact that that is not going to happen. And maybe that's why she does it. It's just like, I don't know.
I think that that's what I feel like that's what's kind of implicit, is that it's that complete... What's the phrase? Like, she's, like, shipping the idea of her employees having another kid.
Yeah.
And the ship was sunk. So,
or is it that she's so far in this delusion about this new baby that she's like, the distraction is the children. And if I get rid of the children, they will have time to have another child.
See, I think this is the one thing that I just found a little bit unrealistic about the plot of the book. Even though I was, like, on board, I was buying it right to the very end. I think on reflection, I remember us sitting in the Nag's Head with some of our pals talking about it, and I just couldn't quite believe that something like that would be enough to cause her to kill the children.
Yeah.
It just doesn't quite work for me. How did you feel about Louise as a character?
She's really interesting, because she's, like, the perfect nanny, the perfect employee, But there's just, as obviously as you can tell from like how it all plays out, there is just this like layer of darkness and this inability to like create relationships with, as you said, like create relationships with adults. Like, she doesn't bond with any of the other nannies. And that's, I think that's something, I don't know what it is, but the what you said earlier about like class and race is that she is like the only white French nanny in that whole network of nannies that go to the same playground. So yeah, that's a thing. I don't know what that says about her, but like she's still choosing to do this job that for everyone else has been like passed on to kind of immigrant women or like poorer women who can't get other jobs. Yeah, I don't know.
But she certainly tries to hide her financial situation as far as she can as well, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She tries to really differ herself from the other nannies, even though her living situation is...
probably just, worse than that.
Yeah, yeah, it's an appalling situation for anyone to be in.
Yeah, and, like, she takes obsessive care of the things that she has. Like, she polishes her shoes with, like, a toothbrush and...
See, I'm trying to find...
Is it the bit with the chicken?
No, before the chicken... One of the early things about her that Miriam finds disconcerting, I think it's related to the chicken, is the food that she saves, that she obsessively saves.
Oh, yeah, the tiny boxes.
Everything. And one of them is one spoon of broth, which I just find so bizarre.
Yeah.
Like, it's
you
the
can't
kind
use
of thing
that.
That. It sounds so exaggerated. Where do you even end up? How do you even end up with a spoon of broth?
Yeah, and then
what
how do
the
you.
Story with
how
the
do
broth?
You preserve it?
Yeah. And what do you plan to do with it?
Mm.
Like, it's just so unfathomable.
And I think that how that then kind of has an impact on Miriam and Paul, how they just become, ashamed of, like, what they have, but it doesn't really change their behaviour in, like, a positive way. It just means that they know to hide it. So when Miriam buys new clothes for herself or the children, she, like, hides it in a bag.
She starts, yeah.
And it's just, I think that's really interesting, the extent to which this person that they're employing can have this real impact on how they behave. Like, the employers, the kind of the rich, the middle class people in their nice flat, become so consumed with what their nanny thinks of them that starts to kind of change how they behave. That's an interesting thing to me.
How does he change his behaviour, or is it just Miriam?
No, it's just Miriam. Paul doesn't give a shit about anything.
Here's the section. In Miriam's refrigerator, there are boxes. Very small boxes piled neatly on top of one another. Yada, yada, yada. Little slices of lemon, a stale cucumber end, a quarter of an onion whose smell pervades the kitchen as soon as you open the fridge door, a piece of cheese with nothing but the rind remaining. In the boxes, Miriam finds a few peas that are no longer round or bright green, three bits of ravioli, a spoonful of broth, a shred of turkey that wouldn't feed a sparrow, but which Louise carefully kept anyway. It's just so kind of disconcerting and strange. Although that actually comes up way later in the book than I thought it did. It's on page 143.
Of a 200-page book.
Yeah, so it's actually, it's like right before
everything
the
starts.
Chicken.
Yeah.
It's literally right before the chicken. So actually, the first weird thing is her hide-and-seek.
Yeah.
Which is so creepy to me.
Yeah, the way that she will not stop playing until she is found. Like, she won't just be like, cool, we're done now. Let's.
Even when the child starts getting distressed.
Yeah.
When the little girl starts crying and feels abandoned and is clearly really scared.
She will not come out.
Game.
She will not come out.
And it's something that, like, if any other adult witnessed that, you would be like...
That's not normal.
Sacked.
Like, yeah. You're traumatising my child.
You're intentionally doing something really damaging.
Yeah. I thought the chicken was a very memorable scene. Because we both remember it.
The almond soap?
Yeah.
So I remember our vegan friend Kish was asking us about the chicken scene specifically, and our friend Jenny painted this, like, horrific picture of what a chicken carcass is like. Because it's been a long time since I've seen a chicken carcass.
Yeah.
And I think that combo of, like, Jenny painting this picture of this, like, greasy, gristly, disgusting mess of meat and skin and bone, and then the idea of someone washing it with an almond hand soap.
And there is no meat on it. Like, there is no gristle. There is nothing. It is, like, completely clean bones. And knowing that she made the children do that to kind of... I don't know. I think that is a... I think maybe the chicken is, like, the beginning of Louise becoming, like, actively malicious towards the family.
But Miriam still feels guilt. Like, she feels that by throwing the chicken away, that it was kind of, it was a decadent kind of reckless way to treat food, and she feels genuinely concerned that she humiliated Louise, and that's why Louise punished her for it. Like, Miriam is still trying to excuse this really irrational, strange behaviour by kind of internalising
yeah.
the guilt.
But you know that that Louise did it to make her feel something bad. Like, that was definitely, like, that wasn't just, like, a kind of passive thing or a part of, like, normal housekeeping. Like, to do that, to make the children eat every tiny bit of meat from the bones of the chicken, to then wash the chicken and put it on a plate and leave it out for the mother to find after she'd gone. Like, that's very, like, calculated and shows a kind of level of malice. I don't know, something. Malice? I don't know.
It's sort of premeditated.
Yeah. A lot of effort went into this, and
There's a lot of time which you can be like, is this the right thing to do?
Yeah.
In this situation, is polishing the chicken bones with this almond soap
a productive use of my time? 100%
necessary to prove my point. She had plenty of time to decide against doing that, but she obviously went all the way to the end.
And Miriam doesn't tell Paul about this because she's like, I think it almost feels like she couldn't explain it. Or does she? Because there's things that happen that Miriam doesn't tell Paul about, because it just feels too weird to try and explain why it's a problem. I can't remember if the chicken is one of them.
Know that they definitely, it's like the whole food thing is a running joke between them.
Yeah.
And I think it's a joke that when Miriam realises how bad Louise's financial situation is, she starts to feel incredibly guilty that they basically take
they behave decadently themselves, and they also make fun of Louise being so, like, scrimping and, yeah.
And I think that's where race comes into play as well, because Miriam specifically doesn't want a North African nanny because she doesn't want to have any kind of... She doesn't want to have a close relationship with her nanny. She doesn't want the nanny to use the fact that they're both kind of from the same geographical area to kind of curry favour, or... I think she specifically says to talk to her
in Arabic
about their own lives and problems. Like, she doesn't want that.
Yeah.
So she goes into the situation wanting to maintain a distance, and she specifically wants a white nanny who just speaks French. And she ends up in exactly the kind of situation that she was really concerned about, which is feeling horrific, like, not horrifically, but very overly invested and very concerned about the kind of well-being of her nanny.
Without really knowing many details of it, all Miriam and Paul know about Louise's life is that she has some kind of financial trouble because the tax office send letters to their house. And there's that weird bit really near the end.
I was going to say, because that happens right at the end.
Yeah, like pages from the end where they see her out of the car window.
What was that? I remember the scene. What happened though?
The tax office stuff does not happen at the end.
I thought it did.
No,
I thought
that happens like halfway through.
Because that's when Paul, who is just this useless... I'm going to borrow a phrase from a tweet that I saw recently that really made me laugh. He's like a stale ham sandwich of a man.
Yeah.
But he has absolutely no chill whatsoever and freaks the fuck out. And he has no concern about humiliating her. He's just furious. Whereas Miriam is, like, hiding her shopping and doing everything she can to try and... to try not to humiliate her. Or her perceived idea of what will humiliate her. Or make her judge them.
Yeah.
So when does the... What happens in the scene when they're watching her?
So it's really, really near the end. And they are so Louise gets really upset because, without warning her too far in advance, the parents take the children to Paul's parents' house. And Louise gets very, like, disgruntled about this. And they still go, whatever. But on the way back from the house in a different part of France, I don't know where, they see Louise out of the window in her, like, depressing suburb. And it's just, I think it kind of, it's the first time that they've ever really thought about her existing somewhere else, not in relation to them. But that happens not that long before all the horrible things. So, yeah, I think it's yeah, it's part of a situation where she feels like rejected and not needed by them, because she doesn't, they don't ask her to go with them to the family, you know, to the, I don't know. But yeah, that happens this really late.
Isn't also a factor of it is that she doesn't want to be in her home.
So
if she's not in her home, if she's not with them, rather, she has no reason to be in their house.
Yeah.
And, like, the way that she very slowly starts staying the night.
And has a towel that she hides in the airing cupboard because she can't use her own shower and she uses their shower. But she, like, yeah, she, like, puts her little things in.
Keeps
tiny...
Keeps it, like, on the DL.
Yeah. And then when they go on haul... What happens? Why is she left... Where do they go?
So the first holiday she goes with
them.
And what happens on that trip? I know it's when Paul starts trying to teach her how to swim. And there's this kind of really uncomfortable scene where I began to think maybe he was going to fall in love with her. Where he's holding her body, like trying to teach her to float on her back. And he realises how thin and small she is.
And it's the first time he'd really realised that she had a body or something like that.
Yeah, like it's so dehumanising. Yeah. Like they don't think of her as a person with, you know, physicality at home, a life outside of the job. And yet at the same time, they kind of expect her to...
Give up everything for them.
But there's a bit... Cool.
I don't know where everyone's gone, but you know the bit where her friend Wafa, who's the other nanny who gets married, and meets her boyfriend at the wedding, and... I can't remember where the family have gone. The bit that I was thinking of is actually, I misremembered at which point in the book they go to Paul's parents' house, and it's that trip where everyone goes, Louise gets left behind. Louise doesn't like Paul's mum anyway, but Louise does not get asked to go, and that's when she stays in their house while they're gone. A few hours after Paul and Miriam's partner, Louise retraces her footsteps and goes back up to Rue Hauteville. She enters the Massey's apartment and opens the shutters that Miriam has closed.
She changes all the sheets.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
shakes out the rug and
weird, unnecessary housework. Oh, and she bumps into the neighbour.
Yeah, so that's the thing that I think is really interesting is the chapters that are about different people. The one about Mrs. Grimberg, the neighbour who should have been able to hear the children getting murdered but didn't because she was asleep with her shutters closed or whatever. There's a chapter about Stephanie, her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chapter...
Isn't there a man?
There's a chapter really near the end about the boy that she used to look after having to give evidence. There's a chapter about her early life. Oh no, that was in the Stephanie bit. Yeah, I like those. I felt like...
It gives the whole book like some good texture.
Yeah, and because she is a character that you don't really know about the, like, psychology of her too much. It's a way of understanding her through other people.
What do you think of the narration?
I like it.
It's close third person.
Yeah.
And it skips between different characters. I'm trying to find, there's this line that I read this morning that I was like, huh, that's interesting. There's a line that's something like, when Miriam speaks of this, she... And almost as though the narrator is a character themselves that has spoken to the various people of the novel.
Yes.
Interesting. I'm glad that it doesn't have that feel to it, because it doesn't need it. It doesn't need
another eye, yeah.
Platform, framework.
Yeah, because I liked it because you couldn't... It would be a totally different book if it was done from Louise's point of view. That would make it more like a straight-up thriller, and I don't think it needs that. And I think leaving you being like, why did she do it? Like, although I think there could be slightly more context, I do quite like that we aren't, like, inside her brain all the time.
Well, I also like that it's quite a sparse novel. Like, it's very short.
It's 200 pages. It's, like, 204 pages or something like that.
So it's really short, and it's non-chronological, which I think is, like, a real achievement.
Yeah.
To tell a story like this where there aren't really any surprises, like... This is our first episode. It's like a spoiler fest, but also I'm not really sure what we wouldn't be able to say if this was just a regular episode, because you know from the beginning it's the nanny. You know very early on that her like circumstances are completely different to her employer's, because that's kind of a given, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's the nature of a nanny.
Sort of expected. And yet it's still so gripping.
Yeah, and I think that is... I mean, it's kind of... to do with the writing, and it's kind of to do with wanting to understand how what happened to make this the logical endpoint?
So I have another question.
Hit me.
Okay. US title is The Perfect Nanny.
Nah.
UK title is Lullaby.
What's the French title?
Lullaby, but in a French accent.
Lullaby.
Lullaby.
Is it?
No.
Oh, okay.
Let's Google it. I saw a thing as well.
Oh, Twitter. Chanson Douce, which is Lullaby. That is Lullaby. Oh, okay. Yeah.
I saw a thing on Twitter just comparing the two covers, which I thought was... It's interesting that it's a different American publisher. In America, it's Penguin. UK, it's Faber. And it has the same cover. What's that about?
Maybe they just decided it was the perfect cover.
Are they allowed to do that?
I don't know.
Also, on the UK edition, it has international bestseller and winner of the Prix Goncourt. It's not on the American version. They don't mention that at all.
Yeah, they don't give a shit about that, those Americans.
Neither versions have the translator on the cover.
Yeah, whereas it is on in the inside. Like, that's I know right, the name of the person.
Although that said, I guess we're both looking at proof, so I don't know if the finished cover has any differences. But you don't like The Perfect Nanny?
No. I don't like it. It's just... That's what you'd call a straight-up thriller. That's what you'd call a thriller that you buy in the airport. That you want to read on the plane because it's just going to suck you in. Rather than, like... Obviously, this sucked us in, but for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean... So I feel like when... Especially when we talk about genre and where books fit, whether or not you should, you know, shelve them in the thriller section or general fiction, it's always a kind of slippery conversation about kind of genre snobbery versus aesthetics and what have you. I think The Perfect Nanny makes for a great title. I just don't think it's the title for this book.
No, not at all.
On the flip side, however, it does kind of annoy me when books have the same titles as other very famous books for hashtag purposes.
Yeah.
Chuck Palahniuk has a book called Lullaby.
Oh, okay.
Which is a very different book, obviously. So I had, like, Instagram issues trying to just find photos of this book. The only way you can really track them down is by searching for the author's surname, which is obviously quite unique.
Yeah.
So in that regard, I don't know, I feel like The Perfect Nanny probably has better, like, social media content capabilities.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, is that a good basis for choosing a book title? Probably not. But
I just don't get why you need to change it. I think that's maybe my main beef with it is... It is a good title. It works. It is a direct translation of the original title in the original language. Why not go with that?
I wonder why they didn't.
If anyone is listening who can tell us why.
I just want to say, I love the way that she just leant into the mic and then, like, really, like, shouted that.
Yeah, tell us. Yeah, okay, so I don't think The Perfect Nanny is a good title.
Agreed. And then my final question is, what books would you recommend to fans of Lullaby?
Actually, I know that I may just be saying this because it's also French, but The Adversary, which I talked about sometime last year in the Contemporary True Crime episode.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. There are... I don't know, there's just things that I felt they work well together.
Vibes.
Yeah. Mm. That would be, like, top of my list of what I would think.
I think the top of my list of just similar titles would be, I already mentioned it in this episode, Emma Flynn. Little Deaths.
Yeah.
I always forget that title. I don't know why. Yeah, Little Deaths. I feel like thematically they are very similar.
Yeah.
In more ways than one. Now we know that this is kind of inspired by true crime.
Yeah, I think that would be a good choice. Because they are both about kind of class and womanhood and...
Motherhood.
Yeah.
And distressing themes of child murder.
Yes. Yeah. One of my favourite themes.
That and Forbidden Love.
Forbidden Love and killing children.
Oh, God.
My forbidden love is child murder. What else? Is there anything else that is, like, even if they're not, like, thrillers or...
So I'm trying to think, because I guess I would... I mean, I'd recommend this book to people who like thrillers but also have enjoyed some of the kind of more commercial literary fiction centred around women that have come out in the last year. So, for example, Conversations with Friends.
Yeah.
There's nothing thematically similar between the two books at all, but if you're the kind of reader that likes stories about women...
Yeah. Do you know what I actually think could be semi... not thematic, I don't know, there's just something, there's a vibe... is a book that came out a few years ago that I loved and I would love to reread to see if I still love it, which is Hausfrau by Jill Alexander Essbaum.
Now, you know what? Someone recommended that to me. I think it was our friend Becca DP.
Yeah.
Because it is similar to Rebecca, apparently. Like, someone said it had, like, real Rebecca vibes.
Yeah, I don't think it is, but someone could tell you that. I don't know.
I don't know. I started reading it and I just couldn't get into it at all.
Yeah.
It's here somewhere on my
shelf. It's there. It's up there.
Can you see it?
Yeah, could go for that. But yeah.
Good chat.
Yeah, I feel like we covered everything I would want to say about this book.
I don't
think
I have anything else to say.
We have no additional content.
I have no additional comments. Thank you for listening.
Cool. So we want to hear what you think. Like, this is the whole point of doing this way, is that, you know, Alice and I love talking to each other, but we talk to each other a lot. So we would like to, you know,
join in.
Yeah, we'd like to invite you into our bedroom.
Invite you into my ears.
So Tuesday evening.
It'll be Tuesday evening. I reckon that we will usually do the chat at 7 p.m.
Yeah,
that seems like a sensible time. So keep an eye on the old Twitter sphere for that.
Yeah.
And also on Tuesday, we will announce what the next book is going to be.
Oh my God.
We haven't decided.
We don't
yet.
Know. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for hanging out with us.
And for listening to our in-depth chats about Lullaby by Leila Slimani.
If you have any book club suggestions.
Yeah. We might not, like, take them, but they will inform what we know that people want to hear about. So that's like our disclaimer. So do tell us if there's a book that you're like, a kind of a semi-recent book that you're like, we would like to, I'd like to hear Alice and Bethany talk about that. LSK. Where can we be found on the internet? So we are on twitter.com, especially this
especially
week.
This week.
We are at What Page Pod. What are you, Alice?
I'm at Smoke and Tofu, no G.
I am at Bethany Rutter. On Instagram, we are also What Page Pod. Mm-hmm. You are also Smoke and Tofu, no G.
That's me.
I am Bethany _ Rutter. We don't normally give our Instagrams, but you know.
No, well, why not?
Yeah, email us anytime you like to whatpagepod@gmail.com and we will endeavour to get back to you. Unless you send us a weird email, in which case
we
might not.
Ignore it.
Cool. I will come
catch
back
on the,
soon.
Catch you on the flip side.
We will both catch you on the flip side. Right, peace out. Bye.